Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.
The advice and opinions expressed by the host of Autism Live and her guests are meant solely as suggestion and should not be in any way construed as child-specific advice. The Center for Autism and Related Disorders advises working with a board-certified behavior analyst who has experience with autism before starting any intensive behavioral intervention. Any choices you make in determining your child's treatment are completely at your own discretion.
Good morning, everybody.
I'm Nancy. Welcome to Jackson.
Yes. And I'm Shannon. So glad to be here with you, Nancy.
Glad to be here with you too, Shannon.
Your hair's looking particularly fabulous.
Well, thank you very much.
I haven't seen you in over a year. it's great to see you on camera, at least. Thrilled to be here with you. We got a great show for everybody. We're going to cover a bunch of news stories, and then later, we're going to be joined by Vince Redmond's going to be with us. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we're so excited that you guys are here with us. Good morning, Christina. It brings up the point that we're live right now, and you might be watching us live on our homepage, autism-live.com, or you could be watching us on YouTube or Twitter, or on Facebook, or one of about 10 different sites that we're live right now. But I will tell you the quickest way for us, if you're watching us live, the quickest way to get your comment read or for us to see that you're watching is to give us a shout out from YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter, because those, we get to see your comments immediately right here. If you are watching recorded, and we do record the show, it is a podcast. It's a free download wherever you get your podcasts. We are the number one rated podcast in the autism arena worldwide. Thanks to all of you. Get your free download wherever you get your podcasts. And then if you want to comment and you're watching us recorded, the best way to do that is to go to the chat that is on our homepage, autism-live.com. Now, I will tell you that it is not an interactive chat. It goes one way. So you send us a message and then we're able to get it and talk about it on the show. We aren't able to respond back to you directly on the chat. So that's a thing I like on my Christmas list, but Santa has not delivered yet. Maybe someday, but we're excited to be here. And I think the most gratifying part of this show for me, and tell me, Nancy, for you, is when you guys talk to us.
Yes, absolutely. Wonderful to have feedback from our viewers.
Yes, and Parker is sharing. Look at Parker being so useful. Shared the website for you if you're watching on Facebook, autism-live.com. Thank you, Parker. That's so considerate of you. And Christina says, I finally got a speech evaluation for my little from an SLP, a speech and language pathologist. It was difficult to hear the results, and he will have an AAC evaluation later this month. And I know that that's a hard one, Nancy. I think that, I lived in fear that they were going to say to me that my son needed to go to an AAC device. I now understand that if they had that more kids talk now than ever before, because we give them an AAC device early.
Right.
So don't give up.
No.
I know people that have had, like, you know, been told your child has apraxia and it's unlikely that they're ever going to speak, and their kids are talking now.
Absolutely.
It takes longer.
I know many cases like that. Many of the kids Wyatt went to school with in preschool were nonverbal as 2 and 3 year olds, and then started talking when they hit 4 or 5.
And I also know the flip too. I know people that are not able to vocally communicate, but I'm thinking of one person in particular who is such a light in our lives that has maybe a 3-word repertoire that he can say, but he communicates in a lot of different ways, including on a device, and that he texts his parents now. That one of the most amazing days in my life, Nancy, was when I was at your son's 18th birthday party, and the dad of this other gentleman, because he's an adult now, the dad showed me the text that he sends him. And it just, I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that he had that much to say, but he does in text. So it's, you know, and that's not anybody's favorite choice for your child to end up having to communicate in that way, but it's ever so much better than not having the ability to communicate at all.
Absolutely.
Yep. And I know Christina is writing in that one of the hardest things when you get an evaluation, I remember the first time that my son had an evaluation and they were sitting in a room full of people and reading off what his scores were, Nancy. Now I would know enough to say, this is not appropriate. You need to give this to me in writing, you know, 2 days before so I can have a moment to cry over it. But I remember there was something that I think on the language scale, my son was at a 3-month-old.
Uh-huh.
And he was 2.5. And I was like, oh my gosh. And just remember, you know, like, things can be worked on. I love the saying from the Marigold Hotel movie that it's all going to be okay in the end. And if it's not okay now, then it's definitely not the end.
Right. I love that too.
Okay. So, Miss Nancy, we got a bunch of news this week.
Yeah.
I just couldn't stop with the stories.
The first story that we're going to cover is from Scary Mommy. Do you know that blog site, Shannon, very well?
I had heard of it and been on it, and then I hadn't been on it in forever. Uh-huh. And so then I was excited to go back. I'm looking to see if we have the same one. Is it the prom one?
No, this is the activities for teens.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. So, yes.
Awesome. I particularly activities for teens with autism that develop important skills.
And I thought this was particularly great because we're at the beginning of summer. And the other day I went through a whole bunch of things about what to do for summer. But we were talking about younger kids. It gets harder when they're teens because you start to get pushback in lots of different ways. But I love this article. What did you think, Nancy?
I thought it was a great article. They have suggestions. There you go is the website, scarymommy.com. They have suggestions for teens on activities that help with areas of development. And some of them are kind of, you know, maybe you wouldn't think. The first one is board games, which is great because it helps improve conversation and problem solving skills. And, you know, board games, obviously, you need more than one person, but they're great, great vehicles for communication.
Yeah, Card did a lot of board games with Jem. Did you guys do a lot of board games with Wyatt?
Yeah, and we still do board games with Wyatt.
Because I do the Festival of Toys, I'm all about games and learning, through fun. And one of our categories every year for each age group is board games, because I still think, there's so much that can be done with a board game, including I think they teach pre-employment skills. Uh-huh. Like when I sometimes when I see people who give really poor customer service and I'm like, really, did you never play Monopoly? Did you not know? Like, does that? So I'm all about the board games. I think that that's a wonderful suggestion. What else did you like on the list, Nancy?
I just wanted to also add that I found out my kid was great at Scrabble that I would not have known had I not.
Oh, isn't that great?
Yeah. He has a vocabulary that I never knew he had.
We should play Scrabble sometime on Zoom.
Okay. That would be great. Let's do that. Some video games, they qualify it with some. They get a bad rap, they said, because there's a lot of gratuitous violence and sexuality, but don't let that ban them from your home, because there are some good video games out there.
Yeah, my son, I'm not going to think what the name of it is now, but there was a certain point, I know Scribblenauts was one of the first video games that I went, okay, this thing is genius. That
you have this character. I don't know this.
It's called Scribblenauts.
Okay.
And it's like N-A-U-G-H-T-S. And it's this thing where your character goes along through and he comes across a problem. And it asks you, what would you like to do? Now, this is for kids that are older and that can read, but are having trouble spelling. And this is not what the game was invented for, but this is what it's great for. My kid was a terrible speller. But so in the game, you get someplace and you have to figure out, you have to solve a problem. Like you have to give him something, like a paper airplane to throw up at something to be able to get in the door or whatever. And you have to spell it and you have to spell it correctly or the game doesn't recognize it. And so I couldn't even believe the things that my son learned how to spell. I'm a terrible speller, but he would constantly be like, how do you spell this? How do you spell that? And I would go, what are you doing? Because we'd be in the car and he'd be like, I'm playing Scribblenauts and I got to know how to spell sarcophagus.
Right.
And I was like, sarcophagus? There's the spelling, N-A-U-T-S. Great, great game for spelling. But then later on, there was a game that he played that was not on a mobile device. It was on like a system. And he learned all about history. So he was coming and he was telling me, well, Nero said this. And I said, where are you, you know, are they covering this at school? He's like, no, I learned this in the video game.
Oh.
Because you could play as Shakespeare or you could play as another character. So he was learning about all these people in history and like really getting to know them and know quotes and what they stood for because of this video game. So all video games, are not perfect, and they're not all perfect for me. RuneScape, it worked for me, Parker. I don't know that one. Oh, Parker's saying that the game that I'm talking about is Civilization. That's right. He loved that game.
It really works. So thanks for that suggestion, Peter. Yeah. So don't rule out video games. Number three on the list was music. That also can be therapeutic and be useful in developing speech and language.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So I want to encourage people, go to scarymommy.com and look at this thing of activities for teenagers. Because sometimes, you know, you're just too tired to think about what to do next, but they,
if other people have this problem, Wyatt has a hard time thinking of things to do by himself. And we want to give him some downtime because between, summer school camp and therapy and miracle project classes, he is scheduled out the wazoo. So I built in Thursdays for him to have downtime, and he's often at a loss of what to do. So some of these things are things they can do by themselves.
And one of the things that they, you know, ABA providers do and that CARD does is that they can do this at any age. They create play centers, right? But you make it age appropriate, where even with little kids, with a three-year-old, they set up like five activities for them and they say, okay, and they have the visual schedule and they go, okay, first we're going to play with Play-Doh. And they do this to get them ready for kindergarten, and they play with the Play-Doh and then they ding the little bell and they go, time to move to the next center. And they go to now time to play in the play kitchen, right? Now it's time to go to this, and they go through the five things and they reward them for shifting from thing to thing to thing. Right. And then the next phase, they give them the visual schedule and say, which order do you want to do them in? And then after that, they say, you know, here's 10 tokens. Which 5 things do you want to do? Because they're teaching them to choose which thing to do. So for a teenager, you can do that too, where you make a visual schedule and say, here are the 5 options. You have an hour. Which one do you want to do first? You have to do 3 of them.
Right.
And do the same thing. Because it's like, if they don't know how to use their downtime, they don't know how to de-stress, which is hard.
That's right. So let's move on, Shannon, because otherwise we're never going to get to Vince.
I know, we got so many stories today. I loved this next story from the HuffPost. A beautiful story that was particularly poignant to me because a woman with 2 sons, and her son on the spectrum, he was going to prom and getting ready to graduate from high school. And she said he doesn't have friends and he doesn't have a core group of people at school. And as much as his school has worked hard to make him feel home, that sometimes our kids just don't assimilate the way we would like them to. And he wanted to go to prom and there was no one to go with him. And so her older son volunteered and went to the prom with him. And there's a beautiful picture of them in their suits. I love hearing about this brother, Nancy, because he reminds me of siblings like you, that at one point the mom even suggested to him when it was time for him to go to college to write his college essay about his brother. And he said, I don't ever want to be in a position of saying anything like it's a challenge to be his brother because he's a cool guy.
Right. Like, I love that.
Right. And I know, you know, you're an adult sibling of a special needs brother. And I always say you guys make the best people on the face of the planet.
Well, I think it definitely makes you more empathetic, have more compassion. And, you know, I did a lot of volunteering with David, had Down syndrome, my younger brother. And I did a lot of volunteering at his summer camps and swim programs and various things, and made friendships with other intellectually disabled Down syndrome kids that I spent time with. And I think it really was a benefit to me. I'm happy that I had that experience.
Well, and I, you know, it was a benefit to the entire world because that informed who you became, and you became someone who's changed the landscape of special needs, Nancy. So,
well, thank you, Steve.
It shaped you into who you are. And for those of you who have siblings and you're worried about your siblings, please make sure that you reinforce your siblings and tell them how amazing they are. But also know that they grow up to be really incredible people. But I love that, you know, mom wrote this beautiful article. It's in the HuffPost. I want to encourage everybody to read it because, you know, and at that point he hadn't graduated yet. And she was talking about, you know, soon we're going to be the crying parents in the stand. I was just that parent on a week ago today, and it's a very poignant time, but I think it's a very uplifting, the conversation that she does. It also has, you know, some awareness about the fact that we're not really getting it done at schools for our kids, and we got to do more. But her son stepped up. Her son stepped up, and they had a great time at prom. I loved hearing
about
it.
So everybody, please read that. The next article is a disturbing one that about New Jersey's autism rate. It's still climbing. And in one district, and I think this is the Toms River district, 1 in 14 third graders is diagnosed on the spectrum.
1 in 14, you guys.
That is a huge number, huh?
And well, and this is in a couple of districts in New Jersey. And in the article, they talk about the fact that they think it's indicative of what it's about to be in all of the districts in New Jersey. Now, everybody's going to argue about why this is. Everybody's got their thing about why. Well, you know, New Jersey has a lot of services. Maybe people are moving there. New Jersey has, you know, a lot of factories. Maybe it's environmental. Everybody's going to have an argument. And you know that there are going to be people who are going to say that that's a misdiagnosis. They don't all have autism. And I just want to know, what magic number does it need to be before people listen? I suspect the number is when it's your child. My college roommate, her child was diagnosed with autism 20 years before I had a child. And I would hear her say things, and my hair didn't catch on fire. I didn't run out into the streets. I didn't call my politicians until it was my child. And, you know, when we're at 1 in 14, I guess it won't be long and it will be everybody's child. I said on the show the other day, I think if we could just get every politician that there is before they can run for office, they have to spend 2 days living in the home of a family that has a child with autism. I think we would accomplish more than we could doing anything else, because I think until you've lived it, until you've seen it, until you've been a part of it, you just don't get it. You just don't get it.
Yeah, but with these numbers being what they are, certainly in New Jersey, we're going to have a lot more affected families. That when to say that 7% of 8-year-olds in the one school district and 5% of 8-year-olds statewide have autism is shocking, to say the least. So we'll see how these numbers continue to pan out.
Yeah. We're still waiting right now. The CDC is about to any day put out the new prevalence numbers. I just want to again warn everybody, when those numbers come out, you're going to be told that the prevalence of autism is changing and less kids have autism. And that is because they changed the way they took the data. It's not comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges. So we'll do a bunch of shows about it when it happens, but just know, don't be fooled. They changed the way they took the data, and they changed it for a reason. So
do you know how they changed the way they took the data, Shannon?
I don't. We're going to have Lisa Ackerman on at some point. I need to reconnect with her. Poor Lisa. I've left her hanging on the hook. But we're going to have her and one of her experts on to talk about what it is that they've done. But, you know, they always did it in this really ridiculous way that obfuscated the whole thing anyway, that, you know, they would look at, I don't even remember what age it was, whether it was 8-year-olds, but then they wouldn't tell us for 4 years how many 8-year-olds. So we would always get information that was 4 years old. I'm not saying that they didn't need to change it, but they're going to try to tell you that the numbers are better than what they were before. But you're going to remember that they have a new scale. So there's nothing to base it on. Nothing.
It seems like the numbers would be greater has to do with our next story, because Asperger's is now defined under ASD. It seems like to me it would be an expanded number.
Well, that's what it's been in the past, and they excused it saying that, but I'm being told that the numbers are going to look different. So we'll see. Although that we were supposed to hear it a month ago, so maybe they aren't as good, and maybe that's why they're holding on to them. I don't know. I'm very mistrustful. Can you tell? But I put it in an article. Did you also have the one about alexithymia as well, Nancy?
Alexis Media?
Alexithymia. Did I not send that one to you? Okay, well, let's cover the Elon Musk one, and then I'll come back to the alexithymia, because I must not have sent it to you.
Okay.
But this, you know, this has been a topic. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that Elon Musk came out on Saturday Night Live and said that he is the first person... I believe he said that he was the first person on the autism spectrum, but then later on he said something, he used the word Asperger's.
Right.
And it's created a little bit of a firestorm for people. And even our dear friend, Anita Lesko, we should have her on to talk about it, because I know she feels very emotional about the term Asperger's. And a lot of people do. They're like, why did that term get done away with? And because they're technically, no one can be diagnosed with Asperger's right now. It's not an official diagnosis in the DSM-5 anymore. It's now an umbrella called ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder. And you get a level rating, and it's two numbers that you're given. And but often people only use one number, which makes a lot of the people who diagnose crazy. But they're saying, is it Asperger's or is it level one ASD? And even that is wrong, because it wouldn't be a level, it would be a level 1-1 ASD, if you want to be technical. So, you know, what is it and what does it mean? And so this was an interesting article in WebMD, but I think there's an emotional thing here as well. And that's what I heard from Anita Lesko in this last week, is that she is someone who identifies herself as having Asperger's.
Right.
And she feels like they're trying to do away with, like, the diagnosis that defines her.
Right.
And of course, I want to say to everybody, like, you are allowed to use whatever words you want to define yourself. Like, don't be defined just by the DSM-5. If you feel that Asperger's defines you, it's just not a medical term anymore, but you can call yourself Asperger's. You can own that for yourself. But I feel, we felt as they were changing the diagnosis that people with Asperger's felt like they were going to be cut out of services. I think we saw exactly the opposite. Do you agree, Nancy?
I do. They got more services because they were diagnosed as autistic or having autism.
I think the hard part is that it's such a spectrum. When you can have somebody like Elon Musk, who is literally making rockets to go to Mars, and then you have people who do not have the ability to communicate their most basic needs, that they need to go to the bathroom, and they are on the same continuum, I think it's confusing to everyone. I think it's very hard because it means that we all have to be flexible. We all have to understand that these individuals are exactly that, individuals, and that they have there are things that Elon Musk needs that I don't. And there are things that a person who does not have the vocal or verbal behavior or the device to be able to say, I have to go to the bathroom, there are things that they need. We're all people. And how we feel about ourselves and how we language ourselves should be honored, I believe. But then we have medical terms to describe certain things as well. And I think it's emotional.
We got a comment from Peter Odell. I was diagnosed with Asperger's at 10. I don't feel bad about the DS5 change. And I still get services, he says.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, I think it's a little bit of a generational thing for people who went their whole lives and were adults when the change happened. And now they all identify themselves as having Asperger's. And then some well-meaning person will go, oh, that designation doesn't exist anymore. Like, I think we should stop saying that. I think it's like, because I can see where if I was a person who went my whole life identifying as being Asperger's, and if I said that to somebody and they said, well, you know, that's not a thing anymore, I think I would have a hard time with that. So, you know, I think we can all be a little bit more cognizant and say, you know, we don't need to tell people that that isn't a diagnosis anymore. It's still a thing. And it's, you know, now it would be, well, in some cases it would be a 1-1. Let's talk for just a second about the fact that, you know, one of the reasons why I like the DSM-5 and the classification readings is that I know some folks who are diagnosed with Asperger's and have classic Asperger's, but they need a tremendous amount of support for their anxiety. Like, I mean, a tremendous amount of support for their anxiety. They are not a level 1-1. They might be a level 1-3. And that I think they actually get more unique help for them. Because everybody always assumes, oh, well, Asperger's means that you're so capable. That is not always the case. Some individuals have more needs than others within the criteria. So I think that's why the DSM-5 and the levels are important. But I think it's also important to allow people to identify themselves. Listen, we're doing this across the board with gender and all kinds of things. I mean, I literally the other day had to say to somebody, I need a chart, because somebody identified themselves to me as being a non-binary lesbian. And I was like, I want it. Like, what exactly does that mean? And then somebody else would, you know, used another term. And I was like, I'm old. Just give me a chart. I want to be respectful.
I know. Tell
me what you want and how you want to be referred to. And I'm happy to do that.
It's very confusing, I think.
It is very
confusing. The times they are changing.
Yes. And I want everybody to be comfortable. And I don't ever want to say something that makes somebody uncomfortable. I just want to know. And I think everybody's entitled to, like, you know, if we can do this in gender and we have 32, you know, so-and-so identifies themselves as pansexual and, you know, and this person is cisgender and it's all this, why can't we do that with autism? Like, you tell us what, how you want to identify and just give me the chart and I'm a happy camper. Somebody says DSM is incomplete and people still like to assume our kids and our adults are just misbehaved tantruming brats. Yes. Well, those people we need to re-educate, but I know that, I know I could not walk in my son's shoes even one day. And thank you. Yes, I think our kids are amazing and warriors. And that people who are intolerant of our kids, I just find I have less and less time for them. Is that bad, Nancy? Am I a bad person? That I just when I find somebody who's that level of intolerant, right, I find that right. I just want to say, go get yourself educated. And I don't even want to spend the time talking to them. Mm-hmm. I've gotten less tolerant of ignorant people. So there we have it. One last thing, because I think we have Vince that's here. There's a new study out about something called alexithymia. Alexithymia is when you are not able to recognize emotions on somebody's face. And this new study has shown that they think that a large percentage of people on the autism spectrum have alexithymia, but that we've been lumping alexithymia together with autism. It may be a symptom of autism that you might have alexithymia, but then alexithymia is treated differently than autism. And one of the things in particular is, I didn't even know this was a thing, but apparently old research said that people with autism weren't able to apply things that they knew before to new things, and that was why they weren't making eye contact and understanding facial emotions. But they're finding that that is not the case. Like, duh, I thought we all knew that that wasn't the case. In any case, University of Oxford in United Kingdom has been doing this study. And this study came out, I'm trying to see where it was, published in Cognition in April. So if you want to know more about this, definitely look into this. But they're saying that some of the previous research on autism and eye contact might have to be gone back over because they didn't control group for alexithymia.
And I think that Shannon, does it say how widespread the prevalence of alexithymia is?
I believe that the numbers that they had in the article are that about 50% of people on the autism spectrum have it. And I think it was about, 5% of non-autistic people have alexithymia, but 50% of people on the spectrum have alexithymia. So, and you treat alexithymia different than the traditional way that they're treating eye contact and not recognizing facial features in autism. I will tell you that ABA tends to deal with it more the way you treat alexithymia. Mm. So I find that a little interesting. But if you want to know more about that, we got that in Spectrum News, but the actual study was published in Cognition. So fascinating. Mm-hmm. I find all of this stuff truly fascinating. But Vince is here and we got to bring him in. Vince Redman is a licensed marriage and family therapist who started out his career in autism as a behavior technician. He is actually featured in the film Recovered. And I encourage everybody to have an opportunity to look at that film. I know they sell it on Amazon. It's a DVD and it shows four kiddos at the Center for Autism and Related Disorders. You get to see them when they were just starting out therapy, and then you get to see them as teenagers. They're all adults now. Super fun. We keep saying we need to do an updated version of it. But Vince is one of the therapists that you see when he was just a young pup. Working with one of the kiddos. Then you get to see him when that kiddo is a teenager. And of course, now we get to see Vince on a regular basis because he's a regular here. And now he's been a licensed marriage and family therapist for a long time now. So he helps us out to understand our feelings about some of the things that happen and how we make the whole family unit work. So Vince is also the director of family services at the Center for Autism and Related Disorders and does an amazing job. And I'm lucky that I get to work with him on a regular basis. So Vince, are you here?
I am. Hello, ladies. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So Vince, our topic
to be with us today.
What's that?
So happy you could be with us today.
Thank you. It's always fun to be here. I appreciate having the opportunity.
Okay. So by the way, I said Recovered is available on Amazon, but I mean the service. Like, you got to order the DVD. It is not streaming on Prime. Vince
Which
was just saying yesterday,
about yesterday.
Vince just said yesterday that has to happen, Shannon. So yeah. I got to get on that. But, and everybody's saying hi to you, Vince. I had said that the topic, and we sort of talked about this with another group earlier this week, I'm hearing a lot of people who are having a lot of anxiety and kids having trouble as the world opens back up, depending on it feels like to me the rules change on a daily basis. Nancy, I said I was at Disneyland the other day. I've been locked in my house for over a year, but I went to Disneyland after my son graduated, and I was there the last day that they had masks and social distancing. And the very next day, people kept sending us pictures. There was only, I think it was 45% capacity at Disneyland, and yet 12 hours later, they were at 100% capacity, no required masks, no social distancing. And I know people who were going on Monday and on Tuesday, they must have felt like they were in a time warp. And, right. and if we're like that as adults, what's it doing to our kiddos on the spectrum, knowing what rule when? So Vince, walk us through some of the things that we can do to help our kids and to help us.
I think and you're right. I mean, I went to Disneyland a couple of weeks ago, and it was still, well, I use air quotes, it's at 35% capacity. I'm pretty confident it was not at 35% capacity. There was way more people there than I think 35% is, but that's a side note. But you're right. There's so much change right now. I mean, as of Tuesday, right? We don't know what to do. We don't know where to go, what we can do in businesses, what we can't, what the employees can, what they can't. You got Cal OSHA saying one thing. You got the governor saying something else. You got the CDC saying one thing. And then on top of that, it's summer, right? We just have that natural transition of the kids are out of school. And they're now in summertime.
I guess that's why I've been feeling this underlying stress that I can't figure out what to attribute it to.
Right. So we have everything with the pandemic, which has just kind of predominated our lives for a year and a half. But then we forget that we're also experiencing natural transitions that we've been, working with and experiencing, for most of our lives. We have the summer now. So we have the weather change. We have kids going out of school. Oftentimes we have our work schedules adapt a little bit because of the kids' schedules. And then we have vacations, and now we can take vacations, sort of. Right. We didn't last year, but we kind of can now. So there's a lot of these just natural occurring changes that are coming up. So we couple that with the ever-changing COVID landscape. There's a lot of anxiety that we're feeling. And I think the first thing we want to do is check our own anxiety, see where ourselves are, because again, we set the foundation for what the environment's going to be like at home. Right. So if we're really anxious at home and we're really scattered and we're really scared, our kids are going to also feel that anxiety. All kids, right? Kids on the spectrum, kids not on the spectrum. They're going to feel that anxiety that something's not right, which is going to heighten their anxiety. And in our cases, it's going to heighten a lot of our rigid routines, rigid behaviors from our kids, rigid expectations from our kids, because their anxieties are going to be high. So right now, it's just, I think, Nancy, you kind of hit on it. It's just knowing what's going on around us, I think, will help, right? Yeah. It's the first step in just forgetting, because we really didn't have those traditional transitions last year. They happened, of course. Summer obviously came, but with everything else going on, we really didn't do anything because we really couldn't. But this year,
I should know by now that I have increased anxiety every summer transition because Wyatt's schedule changes so much from when he gets out of school to when he has. I try to keep him extremely busy, and the camps are changing every week. Whether he's in school, whether he's in camp, the classes are changing every week. So it's like I have to be an air traffic controller.
Right. And a lot of these are good changes, right? It's good changes. We have camps again. We have opportunities for our kids to go do stuff. We can go out again. But it doesn't change the fact that it's still change. And it's still something that our bodies, our minds have to wrap ourselves around so that we can process it, we can understand it. And like you're saying, we can navigate it, right? Who's going to go where, what times, what can we do, what can't we do? And then, again, being flexible, which, you know, is even difficult for us, let alone our kids. It's extremely difficult to be flexible, right? I know the three of us, and I can imagine everybody else that's online watching now, have gotten frustrated over the last week just with changing, you know, expectations, changing what we can and can't do, what's expected of us and what's not. So once we can understand that, we can set an environment of, you know, just tolerance and things are going to be okay and positivity and we get through this. Now we can start looking at, okay, how do we set schedules for our kids? How can we set the predictions for our kids? One thing that I always say going into summer, and I know I've said it with you ladies several times, when we go into summer, I think there's this false kind of sense of belief that, oh, we don't need to be scheduled anymore. We can just kind of free flow. Well, that doesn't work really well for our kids, as you both know. We need to stay scheduled. The schedule changes, of course. Of course, there's an increased amount of leisure time and fun and activity time, less academic time, but there still needs to be a schedule. The kids still need to be able to predict what their day is going to be like. What are they going to do next? And if we give them that schedule, we give them time to see ahead what's going to happen because they don't do this naturally. Their anxiety will go down because they're going to see.
Vince, let me just interject and say,
sure.
That's really important. And what we have is a calendar on a dry erase board that Wyatt can see. And sure. I didn't realize how much he depended upon it until yesterday. He was accepted into a camp that had a waiting list. So where there had been summer school, he's now going to be going to camp. And he said, Mom, next week I go to camp and the week after I go to summer school again. And I said, no, you don't. You go to camp again. But I had not changed the dry erase board. So he's obviously very dependent upon that schedule and being able to see what his schedule is going to be.
Right, right. That, and again, it kind of puts us in check, right? It's like, oh, we got to keep up with the schedule. That's why it putting us kind of back in place saying, oh, sorry, my bad, change it. Which is good because we see that it's a functional tool. It's a functional intervention. It's a functional strategy for him to make him feel comfortable with his day and also, you know, to make sure that he's looking forward, right? This is a good way of helping our kids look forward to what's going to happen next in the day.
And I always want to remind people that it's not just our kiddos that deal well with these. You know, when I used to be a stand-up comedian, I had to keep a planner. Because I had to know when somebody booked me for a date, I had to know which date, and I kept a planner for a lot of years. Then when I became a mom, I didn't have a planner anymore. And I was like, I just don't know how to get things done. And somebody said, what happened to your planner? Take your planner back out. And certainly when Jen was diagnosed with autism, I had a planner and three clipboards because I had to keep three different schedules and know where you needed to be. Like you said, Nancy, like you're an army general. You know, deploying people different places. But now, if I don't have access to my Outlook calendar, I don't know what my day is.
Right,
I can't function. And I need that visual schedule. So to make a visual schedule for our kiddos is very functional and very real world. I just like to remind everybody that it's not like we're teaching them some foreign thing. And I love that he's dependent upon that calendar, Nancy, because... Yeah. Like, you know, everybody's got something on their phone or whatever that tells them when their appointments are. So
right.
That to me feels like, you know, like that's awesome and yeah. very much the you know, I hate using the word normal because I think normal is the setting on the dryer. Right. But I think it's a very common thing for people that we find that it makes us more productive to have things visually somewhere on a phone, on a computer, on a thing.
Yeah, obviously. So when you don't know what's going on, you have anxiety. When you don't know what to expect, you have anxiety.
Yes. So ding, 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 ding.
A big thing to take away anxiety is to know what to expect. Now, Christina Mills says her son uses a calendar at school, but she wants to have one at home, and she wanted to know where to find a good place to find a visual schedule. Do you know a
place? I love Pinterest. I love Pinterest for this. If you put in visual schedule in Pinterest, you will get more things than you know what to do with. And you can look and go, well, that one's too young for him. That one's too old for him. Because what Wyatt needs for the visual schedule, Wyatt reads, you know? So his visual schedule is just things written on a calendar. But for little kids that don't read, you need pictures. And they have them, you can get them on your phone. There are apps that have visual schedules. You know, your daily planner, whether you're on Outlook or that's a visual schedule. But Pinterest is my favorite for all of those things. They have ones that you can purchase and customize that are magnetic and that go on your wall or go on your refrigerator. Some amazing people have made some amazing things so that you don't have to. Vince, do you have other suggestions?
No, and I think, and don't be afraid to make your own ideas, right? Whatever works for you and your child. I mean, you know your child better than anyone. So if there's certain things that they like or certain things that interest them, try to incorporate that as much as possible, right? I think Pinterest is a great idea. They have 1,000 different ideas. But again, don't be afraid to be creative with your child and what's going to work best for them.
Yeah, you can even do a key. Like I have... Camp is a different color magic marker than school is a different color than ABA therapy in the afternoon.
I love that because it's all creative.
Right. We can be creative. We could put different artwork on it. I mean, again, it's what's going to be functional for them. What's going to attract them to it? What's going to motivate them to use it at first, right? Later, like where Wyatt is, it's turned into a functional strategy. It's turned into a functional way of feeling good and predicting his day and knowing what's next. He's really learned how to use it, which is great. But in the beginning, it's what's going to attract them to it so we can teach them how to use it. And that's where we get really creative about, you know, if they're into superheroes, there's lots of superhero things on it. If they're into Star Wars, there's Star Wars. If they're into colors and in art, you know, we bedazzle as you know, the best we can. You know, make it look as great as we can so that they enjoy it. They look at it. They're attracted to it. And that will help them learn.
I love they said they love it when we let you talk, Vince. And I take that very personally because heaven knows I've over-talked everyone. But they also say that that right now, this period of time is making my son adjust to more people and it's awful. We were so okay with distancing. He has so much stress and anxiety and playgrounds are over full since opening. And if a park has too many people, we leave and go to another place. I think that many people, and it's very interesting. It's not just the kiddos. I've heard parents saying, you know, I went to Trader Joe's and I couldn't handle it. And I had to turn around and go home. There were too many people. I couldn't deal with it. Or I went here and there was nobody with masks and I couldn't, you know, I couldn't cope. So I appreciate many families have written in and said, while this has been really hard, the COVID has been really hard in a lot of ways, that some of the kids just did better because they prefer socially distancing. How do we get those kiddos back into life and dealing with the anxiety of that? How do we get ourselves doing that, Vince?
It's kind of like the opposite of what we did at the beginning, right? So in the beginning of the pandemic, those of, you know, us and kids that were outgoing and needed attention and needed a lot of socialization, right? That was very demanding, very difficult for them to have that taken away. But like you said, there's another subset of kids and family members where this has actually benefited them because they don't desire to be around crowds. They don't desire to be around others. They would rather isolate and just kind of do their own thing. So it's going to be the opposite now coming out, right? So we're going to need to start desensitizing those kids who have been used to being, you know, being by themselves or being, you know, with a very limited amount of interactions. Now, the one thing I want to warn all parents and any parent that's listening is we have to make sure that our kids aren't isolating you, that they're not keeping you in because of their fear. Right. Or because of their desire, because let's remember, a lot of times this isn't fear. This is just a desire. The kids like, you know, a lot to be by themselves. They like to do their own thing. They don't see a need or a desire to have socialization. But we do. We need it. We need to get out. And part of that is slowly reintroducing socialization back with the kids. Again, going to a very busy park, going to a very busy store, no, that's going to fail for everybody. Everyone's going to be upset. But maybe we set up a play date with a neighbor and we just go out in someone's front yard, or we go to, you know, maybe a community neighbor pool that doesn't have a lot of people there, right? Just getting outside, getting out of the house and starting to see new environments again with varies a little amount of people is going to be very refreshing for everyone, right? So just going on walks again, going to, you know, a store that might not be, you know, not at the peak of its busyness, to slowly starting to get back out again, and then contriving and setting up situations where they can start interacting again with kids. Let's not forget play dates, right? I know those have been gone for a year and a half, but we have to go back to setting up controlled environments where we can have our kids start learning how to interact again.
Wyatt has his first play date. He's a little bit old for play dates now at 19, but he has his first play date in many, many months set up with his friend Brady this afternoon, and they're going to swim. And we'll do it outside. So he's very excited about that. But yeah, they're coming back. Play dates are, and get-togethers are coming back, aren't they?
Right. And remember, I think we kind of Shannon's example of Disneyland, right? There's just kind of this flood of that we feel that we have to go into these environments with a lot of people. And we don't. Let's start slow. Let's start with just one-to-one. Let's start with just going, you know, starting with our play dates again and start increasing those, going outside, playing on the lawn, going back to, you know, doing things in their backyard or your backyard, right? And just starting really small. Then we work out to a park, and then we work out to maybe an event that will involve a couple kids. Then maybe we go into the community, right? Start small, work big, right? Rather than just jumping straight into a big.
And I want to point out, too, that sometimes it's the opposite. Like you were saying, don't let your child's anxiety and wanting to isolate make you isolate. And I have to cop to that in my household, it has always been and continues to be the exact opposite. That it's my anxiety that I isolate my child. And, you know, I mean, there was a time when I was diagnosed agoraphobic and couldn't leave the house while Jen was going through therapy, and I went through cognitive behavioral therapy. And the only reason why I did it was because I saw it was starting to affect him, that I wasn't going places. And that the few times that I would have a panic attack and I would say, I need to go home. And then I watched my child do that. Mm. We were out and he said, I don't feel right. I want to go home. It was like word for word what I would say. And I was like, oh, I can't do this to him. And so I got cognitive behavioral therapy for myself. And I've said since the beginning of the pandemic, everybody, you know, we were all like checking in with each other and saying, how are you? Are you okay? Did you get set up at home? Can you work? Or is your family okay? We were all checking in. And I was always saying to everybody, yeah, I'm fine. I'm going to be fine no matter how long we're here. It's when we have to come back out that you're going to have to get a crowbar and a therapist. honestly. And truthfully, you know, my son has been the guiding force again, that he was like, you know, it's time for us to do this. And his graduation sort of pushed me to that direction because I wasn't going to miss that. But otherwise, if he wasn't graduating, I would still be at home. And I want to point out,
I think like what you're saying, Shannon, is some of us have natural inclinations to isolate more than others. And we have to be on the lookout for that because it can become a pattern.
Absolutely. And I want to point out that Parker said, even as an adult on the spectrum, I tried going to Menards and couldn't handle the mask policy. And here's how specific it is that, you know, everybody's anxiety is so different. Like, I don't know, Parker, is it that the wearing the mask was hard for you, or the fact that other people weren't wearing the mask? Because my husband has a hard time with being someplace for a long time wearing the mask. We didn't go out enough to get used to it. So that's been really hard for him. For me, it's harder when there are people who aren't masked. I'm totally freaked out. I'm like, let's just all put our masks on and leave it that way, which is not going to work either. So I'm curious, Parker, which is it for you? Are you having a hard time feeling claustrophobic with the mask on, or having a hard time breathing? Or are you having a hard time with other people not having masks on? Because I've heard both stories. It's a hard time, Vince. It's a really hard time.
For me, I think we spend a lot of time worrying about what other people are doing and what other people are thinking, and we're kind of looking for a rule that's telling us what to do. We're at a stage now where we have to do what's right by what we believe and what we want to do, right? Nobody can now tell you have to or you don't. It's up to you now. If you feel more comfortable wearing a mask in public, by all means, absolutely wear it. Doesn't matter if you're vaccinated, doesn't matter if you're not. If that gives you a sense of comfort and you feel more safe, it does actually give you more layers of protection. Absolutely do it. If you feel safe without it and vaccinated, and you feel you have your protection, your internal protection, right? Then that's okay. You can now go out pretty much most places now without it. I want us to start looking at what makes us feel more comfortable and not worry about what makes someone else comfortable. Because if you feel safe, that's what's most important to you, and that's how you should proceed.
I love that. In fact, I want to read you guys something that a friend sent me the other day. It's a smidge political, and I forgive me for that, but it says, while the outside world rushes to move on, the experience of the pandemic has yet to fully leave my body. Parts of my body, my mind, my spirit are still trapped in the limbo of pandemic despair, pandemic depression, pandemic numbness, pandemic survival. I will not be pressured to move at the breakneck speed of capitalism that wants me to forget everything. I will remind myself as often as I can to move at the pace of my own healing and be attuned to my own slow and tender needs. And I think, you know, on a very basic level, little political, but on a very basic level, it's just exactly what you were saying, Vince, about how we have right. to honor ourselves and move at the speed that works for us.
Right.
Parker says, for me, it's the uncertainty. No masks at some places, masks at others. It's the other people thing
right.
that you were just
and
talking about.
For Parker, do what makes you feel comfortable. Wear your mask. If you feel comfortable wearing your mask, don't worry that other people aren't. You're doing what you feel now. I think now we're in it's kind of funny, right? This is what we've all, not we've all, but society on a whole has been complaining about is let us make our own choice. Don't have a mandate or mandates that make that choice for us. We're now entering that stage, and that's creating anxiety, right? It's creating anxiety that we actually now do have the choice. There is no more mandate. I mean, there's a little bit, but there's not an overall mandate anymore on what we can and cannot do. It's really up to you guys, which I think is great because we now are in charge of ourselves again, and we can do what we feel is appropriate for us, what makes us feel safe. What makes, you know, again, and that goes with social distancing, that also goes with the amount of, you know, group interactions we have, right? All together now, we're starting to come out of this. And as we come out, right, take it at the pace that you want to do. And I think that was what was in, you know, what you read from your friend. Take it at your pace. Nobody can push you any faster than you want to go. But now the decisions are ours, which I think is great.
Yeah,
right.
Great advice.
And Renee says, when I run errands, I can't focus. So I have to write a to-do list every time or else I forget. Isn't it interesting how we see that when our brain is focused on other things, it's harder to focus on the things we used to focus on. I think that's a really important point, too.
Yeah.
To be gentle with ourselves.
We use visuals all the time.
Yep. All right. We're out of time here, Vince. We want to thank you and tell people what you do at CARD and how you can be reached.
At CARD, I'm kind of a catch-all, really. But work with families, help families with, you know, different situations, different grievances they might have. If there's concerns or maybe there's, you know, just a lot of, especially like a lot of what we've talked about today, a lot of confusion with what we can do and how they can move forward for the, you know, betterment of their family and betterment of their kids. I'm here to always listen and try to help as best we can. They can reach me at my email address, which is v.redmond@centerforautism.com, as it just popped up on the screen. So if there's any other questions or anything that follows our meetings today or some of our other support meetings that we do, any parent can email me at any time.
Isn't that awesome? Vince is amazing. And I want to thank you for being here, Vince. We'll see you next month.
My pleasure.
And I want to thank Nancy for being here too. I want to remind everybody that on Monday, Alex Lynn will be with us. He is a self-advocate. He is the creator of Autism Rocks. And he's going to be talking about what Autism Rocks intends to do as we come out of the pandemic, because they weren't able to do a concert last year. So he'll be with us to talk about that. On Tuesday, it's Temple Grandin Tuesday. We'll be showing a best of Temple Grandin. On Wednesday, we have Dr. Doreen Grandpache with us. On Thursday, Bonnie Yates, special education attorney, is with us. And on Friday, we're going to be covering research topics in autism. And they want to know, does Vince ever do webinars? And he does. A lot of what he does is internal at CARD, but I know he's available to speak at other things, and we could ask him to do a town hall. We do town halls every once in a while, which we open up to the entire public. So if that's what topic would you want him to talk about, and I'll talk to him about it.
Great.
In the meantime, I again want to say thank you to Nancy. I hope that everybody has a wonderful Juneteenth. We have a new holiday. I'm going to learn how to make Juneteenth gluten-free cookies today. So nice. I hope that everybody has an opportunity to celebrate that. And Father's Day this weekend, we're saluting all of the dads. And then we'll be back on Monday. Until then, give your kiddos a hug from me.
And yourselves a hug from me. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.